Homestyle Green, episode 221, Polly Studio, and a house for all seasons. G'day and welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. My name is Matthew Cutler-Welsh, and this week on the show, I have registered architect and passive house designer, Daniel Volkenberg from Melbourne, Australia. Daniel Volkenberg is a student of the 90s. He took the fairly typical route out of architecture school and worked for a couple of different studios as a graduate. During this time, Daniel worked on fairly major projects such as Federation Square in Melbourne. He gained experience in master planning and got exposure to people and practices. But with a desire to own more of the complete process and to fully connect with his clients, Daniel opened his own practice, Polly Studio, at the beginning of 2012. I pick up the conversation with Daniel, asking him how he got into architecture in the first place.
I actually fixated on architecture from quite a young age. I just was really interested in the built environment, probably quite naively, obviously, as a kid. And, you know, I'll confess the Fountainhead did have something to do with it, by Ayn Rand, but not for its politics. Just for the, I guess, the heroic image of the architect was something that I'd sort of latched onto, you know, as a kid.
As a way of being something or as a way of having some influence and some recognition?
I think probably a combination of both, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I mean, as I actually studied architecture and started practicing architecture, it became apparent that, you know, being an architect is not so much about the heroic vision, but it's more about a skill set of actually being able to bring a whole lot of diverse kind of inputs together and make them coherent into a, you know, into a completed project.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's probably actually, you know, one of the greatest skills that architects have is the ability to coordinate and make a whole lot of diverse, often contradictory requirements and bring them together into a coherent whole.
What are the most apparent of those contradictions do you find? What are you having to balance?
So, you know, it's often requirements from, you know, whether it's lots of statutory requirements, you know.
Rules and regulations.
Accessibility, yeah, rules and town planning, accessibility, plus all the various engineering requirements. You know, that can often, you often find that so many different consultants that you work with and they often, they operate within their own domain and often with very little concern for, I guess, what they're doing, the impact of what they're designing on and everything else in the project and how that impacts on the actual aspirations of the project itself. So trying to sort of...
The structural engineer wants to make everything strong,
yes,
regardless of how it looks.
Exactly. And what impact it might have on the space or, you know.
Yep.
And, you know, the mechanical engineer wants the most logical kind of layout of, you know, ducts and things, but without any impact, any kind of consideration of, you know, what that's going to mean for the different spaces. Yeah. It's about really sort of wrangling all those things together. And all the overlays between them.
Yep. And where does your interest, passion, motivation in sustainability come from?
Well, I think it's sort of just become an absolute necessity for everyone for it to be front of mind. So I think,
it,
you know, I've always had...
Was it taught to you that way at architecture school though?
Not at all. I mean, when I went to architecture school, it was really actually, I think in Melbourne, there was a certain there was a kind of school of thought that actually was quite prevalent at RMIT where I studied, which was to actually denigrate, sustainability as a concern in architecture as being somehow, second rate beyond, a sort of pure sense of design and, culture. I think, where I, at RMIT, architecture was taught very much as a sort of a cultural, a representation of culture. And those kind of technical things like sustainability or, was considered a technical thing and of less, less value than designing a kind of really, out there sort of facade. I think it wasn't really, it wasn't accorded much value while I was studying.
Yet you latched onto that as a necessity of your craft.
Yeah, well, it's been increasingly over the last, I'd say sort of 5 to 10 years that's become apparent. But even at lab, I mean, that was one of the interesting things about working at lab was that they had a very, very progressive attitude to that. And they brought in like really good quality consultants to the projects to try and find, the most innovative, sustainability solutions. So we were always trying to push the envelope, I think, a bit. And that was quite inspiring, being in contact with really high quality consultants who were very much at the forefront of thinking about some of these things and how to bring in sort of passive systems. So for instance, at Federation Square in Melbourne, there was, a really innovative way of bringing in some passive cooling into some of the buildings by using a labyrinth system of it was basically a labyrinth of structural concrete ribs where air was brought in through this labyrinth and it was sort of passively cooled and then released into some of the public spaces.
Right. So the other experts you're talking about there, the consultants, they're mechanical engineers, building services engineers.
Correct, yeah.
Were there specific ESD consultants, engineers involved in that project as well?
Yeah, so ESD, they were the ones that were sort of pretty much driving it. So Atelier 10 from London.
Right. And was there a mandate for that from the client or the architect? Or where was that drive coming from?
No, it was coming from the architects who were sort of driving it, really. They were bringing that to the table. Because this, I think, Federation Square very much predated, a lot of these concerns.
Yeah, it was certainly well before Passive House had started to make its mark in Australia. Might have, Green Building Council might have been around.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Tell me about your time in Berlin. How did that come about?
That's quite an interesting story. So I'd basically, I was doing third year and I was thinking about taking some time off from uni to go overseas and perhaps get some experience overseas. And then I became quite interested in the work of Daniel Libeskind, who was practicing in Berlin. And one of the sort of preeminent architectural practitioners who was also teaching at RMIT, he was a guy called Peter Corrigan, quite a famous architect in Melbourne, and he had a relationship with the office. So after a lecture that he delivered on 20th century architecture, I went up to him and just asked him if he would sort of help to introduce me to the practice in Berlin. And he very graciously did that and managed to get an internship. And it was one of the most, it was quite a life-changing experience actually, working there. Just the, it was actually the first architecture practice I'd worked in. So I was really thrown in at the deep end with a very much a, Yeah, I'd taken a year off between third year and fourth year. I was extraordinarily naive, and it was a 24-hour office. So there were people doing all-nighters pretty much all the time. So it was very intense, but it was very international. There were only about 30 people in the practice from all over the world. And it was really, yeah, just a very, very sort of inspiring experience for about 6 months. And at the same time, being in Berlin, you know, it was a great time to be there. It was a fantastic city. There were so many different cultural opportunities. So yeah, it was a very sort of it really sort of opened my mind to lots of new things while I was there.
In what way specifically did it inspire you and change your direction?
I think it was very much first of all, having that direct sort of experience of working in an office. I think that always changes perhaps the way you think about things. So both work, both, you know, in terms of practices, attitudes to the work, maybe more of a sense of reality about what being an architect actually involves. But also just, you know, a lot of the projects in the practice were quite fantastic, you know, really challenging the boundaries of, you know, of structure, material, things like that. And really very much the forefront of, at that time, of what public architecture could be.
Mm.
So, I think when you're in that environment, you get these unbelievable opportunities, these fantastic opportunities to get exposed to different things. And one of the first projects that I was given just was to be responsible for the opening installation of one of their first projects. Their first completed projects was a museum in a small city called Osnabrück. And so I was responsible for actually organising the opening installation of hanging paintings, and there was a sound installation. So suddenly I was sort of, you know, hanging out with the sound designer, hanging out in the museum for a week and instructing, you know, all of these very technical German art curators about where they should be hanging all these paintings. And I was a sort of, you know, 21-year-old guy that really knew nothing.
Yeah.
But just had to step up and do it. So
I assume you spoke German by the stage?
No, I didn't at all. Wow. So yeah, I just kind of fumbled along.
Yeah. Yeah. If you had to summarize a style of that's their studio, everything looks very angular, very into wedges and protruding triangles at obscure angles, kind of contradicting with older, more traditional forms. Has that followed through to influence your personal work now?
Definitely in the sense, I don't think my projects look like Libeskind projects, but there's definitely an attitude about the way that a project is, there's an idea about relation, buildings being related to, in sort of relationship with their surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, that definitely influences, I guess, the form of buildings, because they're kind of being the design of the actual form and shape is being driven very much by specific relationships to, adjacent spaces and buildings.
Yeah.
And so I very much sort of take that on board.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's not so much about making a building look like surrounding buildings, but they are responding to surrounding buildings.
Well, quite the contrary. A lot of those Libeskind projects are completely non-apologetic at
at being obviously an add-on or being very contrasting to the original building.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So it's not about replicating anything, any sort of heritage, but it is about, but they are very responsive. And even if that part of that response is about being contrasting, from a formal, both materials and form, they might be in contrast with their adjacent buildings.
Yeah.
But they are spatially responding and formally responding to those.
So you can honour the existing buildings or neighbourhood without having to copy it.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So,
what's one of your favourite projects that you've worked on since then? And coming back to Poly Studio, what are some of the highlights that you've had there?
Well, probably. The most recent sort of new house that we've just completed, which is which you called a house for all seasons, and this is the first one that is built to the passive house standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not certified passive house, but it was designed to the passive house standard and built to the passive house standard with an air tightness of 0.8, so just missed out on the requirements for air tightness.
Was the intention to get certified, or was it not going to be part of the plan?
Well, the intention was potentially to get certified,
right?
But the key thing was how it performs.
Yeah,
the key thing was for it to perform as a passive house project, without necessarily the certification,
right?
It's actually my own house. So that's been really interesting because I thought that before advocating for these things with clients, I guess it's really important to know what you're proposing. And the best way of doing that is actually, living through it yourself.
Yeah.
So I thought it was a really good opportunity to, first of all, learn by doing, and secondly, that becomes a massive opportunity for for improving my own practice.
Yeah, yeah. So was that a complete new build, or was it a renovation?
A complete new build? That's right. Yeah.
Right. Right. And so what have been the key learning from that experience for embarking on a passive house, but also building your own house?
Well, I think from a passive house point of view, just really having now quite an intimate understanding of, what the requirements are. Mm-hmm. And also, I guess, one thing that's really key is just this distill the requirement for actually having external shading of windows, because we have triple glazed windows, which are really good, but you still the external shading in summer is still so important, and that's something that that's really become apparent. So but in general, I mean, it's really worked quite well.
So just with reference to the external shading, you've gone about that without obvious external shading on this particular house, haven't you? There are no permanent awnings. You've only got an eave on a small eave on one side. How have you incorporated external shading into what is a pretty contemporary looking house?
Yeah. So most of the windows are north facing. So yeah, there's eave protection along the north. Mm-hmm. And that works well in summer. Actually, that's sort of an interesting thing, because in the sort of late spring, early autumn when the sun's that little bit lower, that's where, yeah, it becomes a little bit where you do actually, yeah, need a bit more, perhaps some blinds or things like that, which actually block the sun for that lower sun. So those kind of things is, yeah, perhaps more what I was referring to. On the west, there's a big window which has which has an automatic blind, and that's fantastic.
Right.
And then some of the other glazing has got some screening, some retractable screening.
Yeah. Yeah. How did your neighbours feel about that? Because it's I imagine it kind of sticks out on the street, doesn't it?
It is. Well, I've only had good comments so far.
Good, from good.
People walking past.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's definitely quite contemporary. But there are directly opposite are actually some three-story townhouses, which are quite new as well.
Yeah.
I think in contrast, you know, this house is much more subtle and
right.
so, yeah. And yeah, probably a little bit. More nuanced in its, you know, in its sort of contextual design. So, yep. I mean, the whole point about it, once again, is that it is quite a contemporary house, but it does pick up on, in terms of materiality, picks up on, and it's in, the context is, it's got a heritage streetscape with a heritage overlay, and it's surrounded by, you know, single level dwellings, which are, you know, Victorian terraces. So it does pick up on some of that materiality in terms of brickwork. It's got a sort of metallic cladding, which is picking up on the galvanized roofing that's typical in the street. Some of the formal gestures are really trying to, you know, pick up on those, you know, on those forms as well of like the, you know, typical gabled and hipped roofs.
Yeah.
So. And then in terms of the way it sets back from the street, it really kind of, you know, is adjusted to, you know, the adjacent building frontages.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
There's a series of sort of quiet, you know, deliberate moves that are really, once again, about just trying to sort of set it into its context, even though it is a contemporary project.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm really excited about it. I've spoken to a few Australian architects now, and I think it's quite exciting seeing an Australia and New Zealand form starting to emerge, where we're not being afraid to experiment with the climate, but and also some of those traditional aspects like the brick, but you know, experimenting with what a good Australian design should incorporate, seeing a lot of indoor, outdoor, you know, big opening windows, but also incorporating that. The requirement for a building to be airtight for good performance. I think that's quite exciting to see that. Was it a challenge to have that airtight idea behind the flow of the house?
Well, not really. I mean, I guess because it doesn't really affect the internal planning. Because it's obviously just about the building envelope. But there's obviously some nuances about, you know, not compromising the airtight membrane through services and things like that. The actual achievement of the airtightness was challenging. I think, you know, there's obviously a very steep learning curve for builders.
Yeah.
When they're installing this. And even though, you know, the builder did a pretty good job, he was a member of the Passive House Association. He'd done training, but this was his first actual passive house project.
Right.
So, you know, there were a few weeks of going around trying to identify leaks, testing it continuously, just to try and really improve the airtightness as they installed it. And so I think just having seen that process, you really understand how just very, very small things can really have quite a big impact on the airtightness.
Yeah. What were some of the those key points, what would you do differently next time?
Well, I think one thing is about the way that the membrane itself is installed. So I don't know what the current best practice is from a proclaimer's point of view, but I know that the builder was advised about stapling.
Mm-hmm.
So he sort of stapled it to the frame. It seemed to me that perhaps using tapes might have been a better strategy.
Right.
So, because you're obviously getting much, much fewer penetrations in the, you know, in the membrane.
Right.
From a planning point of view, I think trying to get a cavity between the membrane and the wall lining for running cabling and services.
On the inside. So internal services cavity. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
So don't have that?
Sorry?
So if you've got plasterboard directly attached to the airtight membrane on the inside?
It's just set off by very thin, I think it's a little strip of masonite or something.
Right.
So it's not directly on the membrane. But
right.
Yeah, so I didn't allow for a cavity in this project.
Yeah.
And that was partly because, every millimetre, is crucial on a tight sort of inner city project.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was really trying to minimise the wall thickness.
Yeah.
But I think, perhaps, having had this experience, I think perhaps, maybe a little being just thinking that through, being a bit more strategic perhaps about, where services go and trying to minimise, having a services cavity in certain locations and not others.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a good idea.
Things
to,
like that.
To think about where you might most need it. I get nervous about people hanging up pictures and putting holes in the wall as much as the ease of putting wiring and plumbing in when the tradies are on site. You got to think about what's going to happen as soon as someone comes and hangs up a shelf or puts a big picture on the wall. They're going to stick a nail or a screw straight through that air tightness barrier, and every one of those little holes starts to impact your overall performance.
Yeah, absolutely, that's right.
Are you going to do it again? You're going to looking for more passive house projects now?
Yeah, so I've actually just started working on a new house, the starting brief is for passive house, but we're very much at the early phase of doing that. So I'm really keen to take on more passive house projects, and I'm quite a strong advocate, I think, within when I'm speaking to clients about the benefits of trying to achieve the passive house standard.
How has that next project come about? Is that through your association with the Passive House Association, or have they seen what you've done with this one and are you promoting yourself now as a passive house designer?
So this specific project came about through a sustainability consultant who knew that I'd been working on this project.
Right.
And then he had some friends who were interested in building a house to the passive house standard. So he put my name forward.
Right. So word of mouth.
So I don't have, but in general, yes, very much looking to, promote the fact that I now have experience with passive house.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned in the description of this one, and you can see it with all the exposed concrete you got in the ground floor there.
Yes,
the passive solar aspects. Do you see an intersection between passive solar and passive house, or is there a conflict there?
Well, so far my experience has been that they are quite complementary.
Mm-hmm.
I understand from some of the passive house literature and materials that I've seen that they say that the thermal things like thermal mass are much less critical in a passive house project.
Mm.
But we've just from living in the space, I've sort of found that thermal mass to be quite helpful.
Right.
It's sort of where, especially in winter, it seems to works really well. And in summer, it just kind of really just keeps that downstairs quite cool most of the time.
So, well, I think that's a really important point, particularly for Australia and warmer parts in the Southern Hemisphere as well, that it's crucial to start thinking more and more about designing for summer.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, and that's one of the things that we find is that, I mean, it's probably not surprising. There's nothing, it's probably not a great insight, but the upstairs actually, does gets a fair bit warmer than downstairs in the house, and that that's probably typical. But I'm sure that the one key aspect of that is is all the thermal mass that's in the ground floor.
So by warmer, you're pushing up over 25 degrees Celsius in summertime?
Well, I haven't actually been monitoring it, to be honest.
Right.
It would be, potentially, especially when, there's days, we often have multiple days that are sort of over 35 in a row.
In Melbourne, so, you're getting up to 40 occasionally.
Yeah, that's right. So we can sometimes have those heat waves.
Yeah. Do you have cooling, mechanical cooling in there?
We have, what we did was we salvaged two split systems from the house that we demolished.
Uh-huh.
And we reinstalled those. So, nice. We've got one upstairs and one downstairs.
Yeah. And did that go into the, did you do PHPPV modelling in the design process?
Yeah.
So did that, was that included? You included the allowance for mechanical cooling in the energy requirements?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right.
But it fit within the PHPP. So.
Yeah. 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 I mean, again, coming back to that, the design for Australia specific design, I think that's definitely something that needs to be considered, because it's not always going to be possible, particularly in the more humid climates, to do away with any mechanical heating, cooling, dehumidification when we're doing an airtight construction.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And it's not necessarily something to be scared of if it's still within the 15 kilowatt hours.
I mean, I think the key thing is, sometimes I've had some conversations with clients where they talk about, but we still want to be able to have air conditioning and heating. And I say, but the benefit of the passive house building is it just is really reducing the amount that you're going to need to, be operating that.
Yeah.
So it's not to say that you eliminate it altogether.
Yeah.
Only that it's really going to reduce what you actually have to use.
Yeah. Yeah.
But one thing, just coming back to sort of the passive side of how it works with a passive house, is that in Melbourne it works really well. A lot of evenings we have quite a good sort of diurnal temperature shift,
mm-hmm.
and in summer, so many evenings we could sort of just open the windows upstairs and just get that cross ventilation through the house, just to really purge the house for the for the next day.
Yeah, yeah.
And that worked really well.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, that's that's good to know as well. So you're not constantly just relying on your mechanical ventilation system, but you can open it up and enjoy that fresh air coming through.
Yeah, and it just flushes it out, and even if it you feel like it's a bit warm, then very quickly it feels really nice again.
Yeah. It's very cool to have projects like this popping up around the place, and to have designers like yourself doing this type of work. Where's the best place for people to check out your project, your work that you're involved in?
So the best place is our website,
mm-hmm.
Which is polystudio.com.au.
Yep.
We're also on Instagram.
Cool.
But more of the work is on the website.
Awesome. And how far and wide do you are you working? Are you mostly in the Melbourne area, or are you going further and wider than that?
So far, it's predominantly Melbourne, mm-hmm. and surrounds. But have project, will travel. So
yeah. Awesome.
And that was Daniel Volkenberg from Poly Studio in Richmond. That's in Melbourne, Victoria. And yeah, they're having a bit of a tough time right now, July 2020. So thoughts definitely go out to people in Melbourne who are in a bit of a lockdown situation right now. But hopefully people like Daniel and the industry do keep on able to work and come out the other side relatively unscathed and can carry on the good work that they are doing. Check out Daniel's work. He's got some really beautiful pictures on his website, and you can connect with him elsewhere on social media as well. But head on over to polystudio.com.au and definitely check out some images of that house for all seasons and also some of the other projects that he's been involved with. Thank you very much for tuning in. Really appreciate you taking the time to listen. Now go make a better place to live.